Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe continues to host the program from home with continuing concerns about protecting us all from the COVID virus. Today, Fred will talk with advocates organizing family councils for those in long-term care and assisted living communities. They will discuss their work establishing these family councils to provide a voice for family and friends of long-term care residents. Join Fred and his guests for today's frank and important discussion, and you are invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today by emailing your questions to voices at kcbx.org. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Donna. Glad to be with you today. Thank you very much. Also wanted to interject that if you can't email us a question or a concern, you can call the station at 805-549-8855. And they will pass that along to Donna in the studio and we'll share it. Also want to let you know that if you have questions or concerns that you want to address that are long questions or involved from that stand, we will pass those along to our guests. So you may be able to get a response to some things that concern you long-term as you look from that standpoint. Anyway, my guests today are Linda Beck. She's a staff ombudsman of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services organization in Slo County. Catherine Chirkus, who is the director of care and support for the Alzheimer's Association. And Jenny Molinar, who is a geriatric care manager with Guided Aging. Sorry, it's not Guiding Aging. Sorry about that. I went through that too many times and didn't get it worked out. Sorry. Anyway, we want to take a look at really the history of what's gone on in long-term care. A lot of you may not be aware that that there actually is such a thing as long-term care ombudsman, and we'll talk about what that is. Most of you are aware of the Alzheimer's Association, but we'll also talk about how their work fits in with this and the efforts with the association and my guest today to develop a series of family councils. And those are really a way to put together tools for family and community support members who have someone in long-term care to be part of this discussion. We'll have a good time with that because there's a lot to be shared and a lot that people don't think about. I probably want to start off with the disclaimer that I need to at least share with all of you is it so happens that I sit on the board of long-term care ombudsman. So that's one of my community activities. And Jenny Molinar also sits on the board. So this is not a topic that's unknown to me, but I also have a tie to the organization. And we wanted to make sure that that was at least out there in the public. But that information was good to share. Probably need to start with, and I guess Linda or Jenny will probably take the lead on this. We need to let people know what a long-term care ombudsman program is, because that's that first step of advocacy is part of what brought this desire for family councils about in the first place.
Thank you, Fred. This is Linda, and I am a staff ombudsman with the San Luis Obispo County Program, Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services. I've been with the program since 2013 and joined the staff about 2 years ago. What do ombudsmen do? Essentially, we are advocates for people who reside in long-term care facilities. That's skilled nursing, assisted living, and board and care facilities. We're part of a national federally mandated program, and our services are free and they're confidential. So people can call us if they have a concern about how things are going at the facility, the quality of the care, whether they're getting their meals and their showers on time, essentially anything that has to do with the long-term care environment.
We look at long-term care, and I think everybody believes in their mind it's something that's off on the edge that they don't have, they're not going to have to deal with, hopefully, in their entire life, in their view. They don't look at it as a positive environment, even though it can be a very good support system. When you first started looking at putting together these family councils, what was your first effort to get people even thinking about the fact that if they wanted to talk to other family members or members of other families who had residence in a given facility, how did you first broach that with the very people that you want on the councils?
Well, we actually started the conversation with the Alzheimer's Association last November, which is Family Caregiver Month. And I got thinking about the idea that many people who have loved ones in long-term care facilities don't think of themselves as caregivers because they're not doing the hands-on day-to-day, feeding and changing and bathing. But it's so important that family members recognize their role as a caregiver, even when a loved one has moved into long-term care. And that means that the family, and by family, it's broad, family and friends, that they are providing essential support for their loved one, and that they need all the support that caregivers have available. So because Alzheimer's Association provides such terrific support services for people dealing with Alzheimer's and other dementias, I talked to one of their staff people, and we've made it a joint effort. So we started out with a Zoom, and we announced the program to all of the long-term care facilities in the counties. We started focusing on the skilled nursing facilities, and because they're bigger communities, and that's where we see the greatest need, frankly. So we got the word out that way. We have been sending out information through the Alzheimer's network and some other people who are network facilitators for older adults in the area.
A question came to mind for me very succinctly related to the Alzheimer's Association as you were presenting that. It occurred to me that Catherine, a lot of what you deal with and an Alzheimer's Association are families that don't have someone in long-term care, and that may be in the category of they don't have someone in long-term care yet. And sorting out that yet, or is this the road we're going to follow, may be a tough battle, or battle's not a good word for it. It may be a tough challenge on a regular basis when you're talking to people who are just starting the discussion of, is my family member or am I looking at some limitations that I haven't addressed yet?
Absolutely. And that's something that comes up in a lot of our consultations and interacting with family members. They want to know exactly when is the right time for placement. You say, when should I move my loved one in? At what stage? And they want a date. They want to know when the neurologist will recommend it. They want to know, specifically when that's a good time. Often when we get to what is a good time, and I did air quotes there, because there really is no defined time. Every single case is different. Mm-hmm. But once that time does come up, there's so much grief and guilt that can emerge from the caregiver, where they don't realize, that we talk about a silent promise that a caregiver will make. If it's, a spouse or an adult child or a friend, a extended family member, that they have that pressure on themselves that they should be providing in-home care. So, and what Linda just mentioned, a lot of caregivers, once they are considering placement, are wondering what their identity is going to be. If they've been a caregiver for a long time, they might believe that having a loved one moving into a facility, how can they still be a part of their life? And, how can they acknowledge their loved one and support them in this way? And it's really not clear. that roadmap of how to continue being a caregiver, recognize yourself as a caregiver, but also give yourself the space of as an individual caring on their own life. That is where I think there is so much beauty in creating these councils, and where I think the Alzheimer's Association fits in well, because we do a lot of, you know, identity defining and rediscovery and helping people acknowledge themselves as caregivers, acknowledge themselves as, you know, citizens of their community. And so I think that's a good fit and where the long-term care council is so needed.
Yeah. For clarification, if there is a family council set up, is it tied to a given facility, or are you doing these as councils that are, if you will, region or citywide or countywide?
Right now, we are working on a countywide program for family councils. And that is an effort to sweep in as many people in the community as possible who are in this position. Ultimately, we would love to see the family members for residents in a particular facility working together, because each facility has its own personality and its own set of issues.
Yeah, that question came up for me because as listening to Catherine talk about their challenges with the Alzheimer's Association and the family challenges, it occurred to me that some of the people who would most benefit from this kind of support environment may not have someone that even is currently under care anywhere. And they certainly are not, they don't know that they're going to end up at XYZ facility in Templeton, as opposed to such and such facility in Orchid, California, but they may really need an extra support system for people who've already been down the road they've got to get challenged by.
Ultimately, the goal is to have self-governing family councils at each of the large facilities. We're quite a long way from that. We really are laying the groundwork for those now. And we welcome anyone who has an interest in the topic.
I want to remind our listeners this: we're talking about a long-term care program that the folks at the Ombudsman Association and the Alzheimer's Association are putting together, called Family Councils for Long-Term Care, as a way to really build a better support network for people who are in any kind of long-term care or potentially there. If you have questions you'd like to pose to our guests, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855 or email us at voices@kcbx.org. If you have a long and elaborate question that you'd like some more information about that we don't cover today, you are welcome to also email to voices@kcbx.org either during or at the end of the program, and we'll pass those questions and concerns along to our guests. Jenny, I want to make sure we bring you in the loop, because I think, among other things, you're a private advocate is what I call you. You may have a better title for it than that, and correct me if I'm wrong. But how does this kind of program play into what you do with families, and what are the kind of services you're offering to clients that approach you for help in the first place?
Advocate, I like that term, Fred. Thank you. So I am what's called a geriatric care manager, and I do specialize in working with families that are going through the dementia journey. And the family council allows for the clients that I'm working with that may have a loved one in long-term care, it supplements ultimately the conversations that I may have with them on a frequent basis, but it allows them to hear it from their peers. And it really gives them an opportunity to have communication with individuals that are wearing similar shoes as them, and to know that they're not the only ones mm-hmm. that are going through some of the emotions or having the concerns of, how often should my loved one be having a snack or being changed or things such as that nature. So it really gives them a safe space to ask questions that some of the average folk may not, you know, feel comfortable asking one another. And so I really do appreciate this particular council and program to really supplement it coming from the source and the people that are living this on a daily basis. And I have a background in long-term care. I worked in memory care administration for about 9 years. And this is just such a great opportunity to get a program such as this up and rolling again, to allow, you know, families to really have a group voice. So I'm really, really excited about this on many levels, just from, you know, my background and then also what I'm currently doing right now. So I really appreciate the Ombudsman Program and the Alzheimer's Association in joining forces on this.
The desires of a family to get more information, sometimes I suspect is driven by not an acknowledgement from the person needing the care, but a lack of acknowledgement. I mean, not everybody in long-term care is an Alzheimer's patient. A lot of them may have just as clear mental faculties and reasoning ability as they had when they were 12 or 15 years old, even though they have physical limitations. Those people, I realize, are easier to have the conversation with. I'm wondering sometimes when we're looking at the fact that some of the clients you're dealing with may be very aware of their mental limitations, if they have some. Others are not aware of them at all, but are available to talk about it. And others are so incredibly defensive, everybody wants to hide under a desk when the topic comes up. Are those three separate groups of people that almost need three separate councils to work with the questions?
Interesting question. And let me distinguish between resident councils, which are for the people who are actually in the facility, and family councils, which are for their loved ones and supporters who are in the community. One of the things I sometimes say about long-term care is that it's people don't know what they don't know. It's a foreign environment, and people are, both residents and their supporters, are often very intimidated by the setting. You've got all these people wearing scrubs and name tags and you know, running around and being very busy, and they are very busy and they are working very hard. And people don't seem to have a time to answer their questions or even really tell them what to expect. And the resident and family councils can fill some of that gap. One of the things I see consistently, and I imagine that Jenny and Catherine see it as well, is that caregivers don't talk to each other. We talk about in our culture, we talk about our work, we talk about our dogs and our cats and our partners and our houses. We do not talk about the fact that we are supporting an older loved one or a sibling or even an adult child. And that means that people are missing out on really the best source of information about what's going on, which is other people who are doing the same thing. So the idea behind the family council is really twofold. One is to give family and other supporters of residents a place to get together and learn from each other, a place to get educated about resident rights, because there is a literal Bill of Rights for residents of long-term care facilities. And to learn the best ways to approach staff and other parts of the caregiving community or long-term care community effectively to address issues that come up, because issues come up. It's the best possible run facility is still going to have things that can be improved.
Yeah, I want to put a suggestion out to the listeners that if you have some questions related to not only how you could get involved in this, but where you stand maybe with a family member right now that you have some concerns about, and how the family council may be something that you need available to you even before you have someone in care. That, and I believe that's a balancing act for a lot of people. Gee, if, as I said before, if I knew I was going to go in a particular to a particular facility, I could go visit that facility, talk to some council members there. Yeah. But I may be, by the time we get that far along the process, I would have probably preferred to have had, you know, 20 other conversations. And I'm sure that comes up also. Catherine, does the Alzheimer's Association have any kind of peer networking work similar to the family councils already in place?
No, we do. Our support groups, which are obviously a safe space for connecting with other caregivers, that is kind of the most similar model, caregivers coming together. We have support groups that are based on the caregiver's role to the care recipient, adult children, spouse support groups. But something that's really important, and I do want to say I am here representing the Alzheimer's Association, but also the hard work of my coworker, Laura Deloy, who is the program manager for the Alzheimer's Association, who couldn't be here with us today. But something that we do talk about a lot is the best case scenario is when caregivers connect outside of our work. They, like we were talking about before this show, they find that platonic chemistry in these support groups and realize, okay, you know, this person and I are going through something very similar. Mm-hmm. We are carrying the same emotions. And just as Linda said, a big challenge that we have day to day, even before getting people to support groups or before getting them to go and ask questions, is that caregivers do not talk. And that could be due to barriers, cultural barriers, religious barriers, you know, personal beliefs that I shouldn't be, you know, complaining about this or feeling sadness. This is mom. You know, mm-hmm. She took care of me. I'm supposed to do this as well. And so I think the benefits of having this council start before someone even joins it, just knowing it is there. I think people even listening to this show right now, I hope this gives them comfort knowing that, okay, when I get to the point of transitioning a loved one, even if that's not in the cards now, even if I'm not a caregiver, there is a group that's going to support me, have my back, and you know, remind me of my rights, remind me when to be that squeaky wheel, because there can be that concern, right? That if you are the one, you know, constantly advocating for your loved one and saying, oh, I want, you know, they should be cared for in this way, or this part's being neglected, that little bit of fear that there might be
repercussions
exactly on your loved one. And that's something we hear so much. I imagine Jenny, you do too, and you too, Linda, that someone, there's something that they think is wrong. So I really want to emphasize the benefit of this existing for those that might not even be a part of it for 20 years. It is making something very scary feel less intimidating.
That's such a good point, Catherine. Right. And it's very true. You know, a lot of families are concerned about repercussions of speaking the experiences that their loved one may be going through, concerns, or just even asking questions. And, you know, most long-term care communities really appreciate getting feedback because, you know, they may not know that the family has this concern about their loved one, and B, ultimately they want to have their residents happy and safe and healthy. And that means that their residence is going to be retained there. It's their, you know, they're going to continue to have a positive reputation. So I, you know, always encourage families to speak up if they're not comfortable speaking up, I will help them speak up. I will be their voice. And then from the perspective of, you know, the long-term care facility administrator, I always appreciated it when families informed me of concerns, or, you know, even the family council, or just if a caregiver passed it on. I always wanted to know those concerns because it allows us to continue communication and fix things, because most of, especially the larger communities, you know, having, you know, 60 to 80 residents, it's impossible to know every little thing that's going on in every room, in every station, or on every floor. And so that really allows the opportunity for things to be fixed. So it's, but it takes some guts to speak up, for sure.
Jenny, I'm wondering if this is something that you run into, because obviously someone who chooses to retain your professional services, maybe outside the scope of what they could do just as their own advocacy. So my hunch is you may oftentimes get potential clients or family members of the actual client who needs to go into a facility that want you involved because they're afraid they're going to tick off the facility. You know, one of the first things I would say to you is I have a loud mouth and I'm snappy, and I want to make sure that the administrator of this facility is not unhappy with me the minute I walk in the door and takes it out on my mom.
Exactly.
And I think that probably comes up. And is that a balancing act that you work with often?
It is, definitely. And it is a balancing act. You know, I am a neutral party. And it allows me to be able to express concern that I may have, or share a concern that the family may have, to an administrator, to a nursing director. I can be that one that can share the concern without concern of repercussion, because of my experience, because of my, that neutrality. And so I am often used as the, I don't want to say used, but I often am honored to serve as that middleman. And, you know, I can also, from both perspectives, from the community and from the family, offer and translate what is, why this might be happening, and then talk through what realistic expectations are to fix this. How can we compromise? And so that is a large part of what I do in my practice. And it's, I enjoy that immensely, especially when we are able to find that common ground. And often we find out the concern, even though it might seem very large to the family, it might be a simple fix. Might be a really simple fix.
Yeah, we're going to revisit this some more. We have a lot more time available. If you've got some questions for us, give us a call at 805-549-8855. Email voices@kcbx.org. I have Linda Beck, who's a staff ombudsman with Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, with us today. Catherine Cherkis, who is the Director of Care and Support for Alzheimer's Association, and Jenny Molinar, who's geriatric care manager with Guided Aging. And we're talking primarily about long-term care, the ombudsman program, but specifically also about a program that they're putting together to really build some family councils as advocates and support groups for people who are in long-term care or maybe transitioning into long-term care. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with you in a moment. Donna, it's back to you.
Hi, I'm Donna Cheek and it's 1:29. Let's take a look at the KCBX community calendar. The award-winning Central Coast Follies choreographer is teaching French free jazz and tap classes each Sunday in May for children, teens, parents, and friends at the Delos Performing Arts Center in Pismo Beach. Attendees should wear comfortable clothing and shoes, and students are welcome to come to some or all of the classes. You can learn more online at centralcoastfollies.org. We return now to Central Coast Voices with host Fred Monroe.
Thank you, Donna. Appreciate that. We're glad to be with you today. We are, if you're just joining us, we are talking about long-term care, the need for long-term care for some people, and a desire to put together some family counseling programs at long-term care facilities. We're also including the Alzheimer's Association in this discussion to get a better understanding of what kind of services people need and what kind of questions they have that arise as they think about someone coming into long-term care. This primarily came about because Linda Beck and the staff at Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program felt there was a need for some family councils that are being utilized in other parts of the country, but we're not being utilized locally here to open the dialogue. So Linda, how many councils do you have, or how many people do you have that are interested in this right now? And what are you doing in the early stages of this program?
The early stages have been Zoom get-togethers, since none of us are really sure where COVID is on a day-to-day basis. It also allows us to include people from all over the county and save all of us the travel time and so on. We are building our participation. We've started off small, and one of the reasons we're so excited about this opportunity to talk on the program is that we do want to get the word out and let people know that this is going on. The family and loved ones who support long-term care residents are very busy people for the most part, and it means that they may not be looking at some of the places where this kind of information is usually available. You know, a lot of people are in what they call the sandwich generation. They're dealing with their older relatives at the same time they're raising children and young adults, and it's a very busy world for these folks. I did want to go back for just a minute to what Jenny was saying right before the break about the role of an advocate as sort of a go-between between residents and families and facility staff. One of the benefits of the ombudsman program is that we can accept complaints anonymously. People do not have to identify themselves, and we can present concerns anonymously. We also can move forward with group complaints. For instance, food issues very often affect the entire facility. So we don't need to have a specific resident named as the person who has a concern.
Don't you wish there was an ombudsman for every area of life? Like every grievance I have, imagine if we had what long-term care ombudsmans are, a compassionate, willing, very experienced workforce that I could say, you know, there aren't enough parking spots outside. Can you make this anonymous conversation get going?
The parking ombudsman.
Exactly.
Yes. That's perfect.
Ombudsman.
Well, that I have to interject, and that is coming from three people who obviously like what they do. You may discover there's a lot of people who want you to do it for them because they don't like doing it themselves.
Absolutely.
And that may be a challenge that's a challenge that probably comes up in life for a lot of people in a lot of areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't intend this to transition this way, but I wanted to do that now. And that is that I suspect there are people who have some fear of getting involved with a council for a facility, or in this case, we're still at a regional level, where, you know, the administrator at XYZ facility is going to know that when this concern is presented to them, that it came from me and I'm never going to hear the end of it. And is my mom going to get in trouble because I'm an advocate? And I'm wondering, I suspect the family councils can do a lot to work together to address that, but it may be something that causes a number of people to just walk around the edge for a very long time.
Yes. And for starters, I want to make it very clear that there are state and federal laws that prohibit retaliation in long-term care facilities. And if a resident or a family member feels that they're being retaliated against, we're all over that. And we're very good about developing the facts that demonstrate if there is a retaliatory environment, that's what's going on, and we'll get that stopped one way or another. But that points to one of the things that I discovered, and that was a real surprise for me when I started doing long ombudsman work, which was the level of fear that many residents and their families have that if they speak up, they will be evicted from the facility. And the good news on that is that there are very limited specific grounds on which a facility can ask or require a resident to leave. So it has to go beyond, oh, this person is difficult, oh, this person doesn't say please and thank you as often as we would like them to, or they're, you know, and anyone of countless number of other descriptions of, you know, this person doesn't fit, we don't like this person. And there is often a real sense of relief when I tell people that, no, you can't be evicted, you're not going to be, they can't put you on the street. But those are very real fears. And again, this is the kind of thing that a family council can provide a forum for this kind of education.
I suspect that a good portion of the population we're talking about here spends a lot of time kind of at the edge of living in fear in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because they're dealing with a less than positive transition. I would, whether it's me or an elderly family member, I'm going to be very concerned about why life is not as peachy keen as it was 5 years ago. And I think we're, as a family member that might be part of this advocacy council, if you will, or support council, I may be frightened to open that kind of box of questions for a multitude of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hearing anything like that from people who are kind of waiting around the edge of what you're doing?
Yes. And I was going to suggest that Jenny might be a good person to talk to this, because there is a real grieving process that goes on when a person transitions to long-term care. It is not the life that anyone would pick.
Absolutely. It is, just as Linda said, it is a grieving process. most of the individuals that may have to place their loved one in long-term care, this was one of the most difficult decisions they've ever had to make. They very well may have promised their spouse that they would always care for them at home. And now we're in a situation of where they have to make a decision for their loved one's safety and quality of life, and maybe for their own safety and quality of life, that they need to move forward with placement. And so this is such an emotional and challenging decision to make. And many of them may not have a large support system to, you know, comfort them and to counsel them afterwards. And so, yes, you know, we want, you know, many individuals want to have things go smoothly. And, you know, after that transition happens, and, you know, no, they don't want to ask questions. We don't want to rock the boat. And because there's so many things going through their heads and their loved ones' heads at that same time. And so it is challenging to speak up, especially because we're sad, we're emotional, and we're experiencing such guilt as well, oftentimes. So it is a transition process after placement. And oftentimes, especially when we're dealing with someone who may have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, that we find the actual caregiver that's left on the other end having a much more challenging transition, and their loved one may be doing okay. So this really allows the person that's still left on the outside, so to speak, a forum to you know, share their thoughts and feelings about what they're going through and finding their new full-time job, so to say.
Or purpose.
Catherine, I think this probably plays a lot into what you may see on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. That is that people who are considering the fact that they are not as astute in their environment as they used to be, you know, my thought is, if I were to look at myself as an aging example, I'm 71 years old, I may not want to talk to my wife about the fact that I'm concerned about my response time when I drive, let's say. But if I talk to her, the first thing she's going to do is take away my car. And so, I don't mean to use that as a flip example, but I'm trying to make it as if you will, generic in the example as possible. I'm wondering whether or not there are people who are just in a position where it's fearful to start talking about not only possibly a family member's limitations, but if you are the family member that's developing those limitations, fessing up to them in the first place. And I'm Absolutely. Wondering how often you address that.
Almost always. So first, when I or any of my coworkers speak with someone, a caregiver, it is not the first time they've tried to contact us. Most of the time. I met with a caregiver recently who said that she has driven into our parking lot for like 3 years and has never wanted to get out of the car, because you talk about it and it becomes real. And, you know, going on with that, grief and guilt is very, you know, big emotions, but also the lack of confidence. People question themselves, question that something is actually wrong, mix it up with, you know, normal aging. And I'm referring to particularly, of course, at the Alzheimer's Association, working with adults experiencing abnormal cognitive changes, dementia and Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia. So they second guess themselves a lot. And that trickles over into placement, into a long-term care facility, if this is the right move. And, you know, particularly for care recipients that are further along in their dementia journey, what's going on in their thought process is not nearly as complex as what the caregiver is weighing. And sometimes that could even be post-placement. I'm sure both of you have seen this many times, but if someone is transitioning into a new living space, a new long-term care facility that is designed for that person, if it is a memory care or, you know, has the resources that person needs at that time, if their home was no longer a safe or comfortable place, they might improve or show signs of, you know, functioning better. And that can cause so much second guessing. And that's where having a group of informed friends will remind you, this is for the best. And that promise Jenny said, you know, that if it's spoken or not, to keep your spouse home, keep mom home, just like you said, and it might not be the best option anymore, you need people to help remind you, no, you are doing the right thing. You are doing what's best for you and doing what's best for your loved one. You are honoring that promise in a different way, but you are honoring both of yourself. So going to your answer, yes, that is something people are very uncomfortable talking about out of fear, out of making it a reality, but also they're second guessing themselves for what they're seeing. If they notice a loved one, like you were using the example, is driving differently, and they might be ready to call us and talk about it. And then they might go, you know what, maybe I'm the one that's driving differently, or maybe I'm being too harsh on him. I could just be too harsh. I don't want to get someone involved from the Alzheimer's Association or a geriatric care manager, because then I'm bringing some attention to it. And, you know, that's part of the stigma of aging care, right? That there, it's kind of a taboo thing to talk about. And that's why we're here, and why you said we all love our jobs. We do, because we want to change that.
Yeah.
Because as you say that, it occurs to me that one of the things that you're advocating for is the fact that people's life can continue as opposed to them just giving up.
Yeah.
As Catherine, as I was listening to that and listening to Jenny's comments also, I want to now pose a question to Linda, because it occurred to me that one of the most usable things for a family council may fall in an interesting area that we haven't talked about, and I'm curious whether or not the management of a care facility may want to look at that family council as one of their own best tools. If I'm thinking of putting a family member in facility A, I'm wondering if there are some family members of people who are already here who can give me some idea why this will be a good fit for my spouse. I'm wondering what that does to the discussion between a family council and the administrator of a facility.
Great question, because we had exactly that situation here in the county several years ago. Pre-COVID, pre-various other changes in local facilities, the administrator had, from my perspective, co-opted the family council to be a part of his marketing operation. And that really did undercut the function of it. One of the things that goes along with having a family council at a specific facility is that group is entitled to certain protections under federal law, including the right to meet without the administration or facility staff. And we always encourage people to have at least part of their meeting without any staff present. But it is also an opportunity for the administrator to learn, as you were saying earlier, you want to know what's going on in your facility, to hear from people who have a perspective different from what you may be hearing from your staff. So again, the family councils and the resident councils are really meant to develop the community, the living community, as a whole. And there is part of that that needs to take place in the absence of staff, and there is part of that process that needs to take place with staff. Because the relationships between staff and residents and administration are critical to creating quality of life for the residents.
So administrators that understand that dialogue works well on both sides and end up with everybody happier, and hopefully that will be the ideal.
That is, you know, I would like nothing better than for every family council to be able to get together and say, Wow, what a great month we've had. Frankly, everybody has been so bowled over by the COVID situation that it's going to take a long time for long-term care facilities to get back on an even keel, even to where they were in, 2019.
Yeah. We're down to just a few minutes left. And as our regular listeners probably know, I want to make sure that my guests get as much of the last word as we can give them. Jenny, I'll start with you. Why don't you share with us what you want to make sure we remember and understand about what we're talking about today?
Thanks, Fred. I think the main thing that I want to make sure that the listeners gather today is that long-term care, if you have to move your loved one to a long-term care facility, that it can be a very positive experience if you keep an open mind to it and utilize your resources that you have, such as a family council, such as support groups, such as just, going in and spending time with your loved one. Don't be scared to go there. Mm-hmm. Even if we see, we're looking at a lot of 70 to 90 year olds. You can still have an amazing time hanging out with your loved one in a long-term care community. So I think reducing the stigma, utilizing your resources, whether they be free or paid, I think it's just important because this is a part of the aging process. And this is everyday life that we're dealing with. So staying positive and using and talking to the folks that are out there to support you, because it's so true, as Fred has stated today, folks that work in the aging world, the Alzheimer's world, etc., we love what we do. And we are very, very passionate about it. And so we want to be there to support you through this journey.
Thank you, Jenny. Catherine, your thoughts?
Something that I would really want to stress is that in our society, we look at aging and the challenges that come with it. That's just how we view that, especially in California, aging is a challenge. The biggest challenge in terms of aging, Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia, is when you are isolated with it. And that does not, no one is spared from pain of isolation. This is my job and I am so passionate. I love doing it. If and when I come to the point of supporting a loved one, either in transition to a long-term care facility or somewhere else, you best believe I'm probably going to call one of the ladies that's on this call right now or join a long-term care. We all will experience grief. No one is spared of that. Do not put extra grief, sadness, challenge on you by staying isolated. That's just the first step. There are, as Jenny said, so many amazing resources out there, but again, you can't know what you don't know. That is what people have dedicated their lives, their careers, their passions to, are collecting those resources together. So the first step, ask for help. We will all be so proud of you. And it'll make life a lot easier when you ask for help.
Very good point. Linda, you have to top that. No, seriously.
That's a tall order. this is one of those scenarios where there truly are no stupid questions. Reaching out and asking whatever it is on your mind is the first step towards making the situation more manageable. And this, applies across so many things, but the Ombudsman programs are nationwide. We are available, not 24/7, but we are very responsive to calls we get from residents, from families, and the services, again, they are free, they are confidential. And the family council that we're working to develop is really the next step in supporting people who have loved ones in long-term care, trying to create a more positive experience for the people in the long-term care facilities as well as their loved ones. And I think I'm going to stop there.
Well, I have a final question for you because we have a little bit of time here and I'm curious. And that is the people who want to get involved in your family councils, they will find you by contacting the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program?
Yes. Okay. Our phone number, if I may, is 805-785-0132. We are also available at ombudsman@ombudsmanslo.org. I wish they'd picked a different word, but thanks to the Swedes anyway. Ombudsman is ombudsmanslo.org.
Thank you all. I think I really appreciated this, and it's information that a lot of people hopefully will be able to utilize. And I admire the programs you're putting together. Thank you very much. This is Central Coast Voices. I want to remind you that next week, Chris Kington Barker will be here. She's going to take a look at the Central Coast child care crisis. Joining Chris will be community advocates coming together to discuss the current state of the child care crisis in San Luis Obispo County, which is a lack of adequate child care for an awful lot of families. And not only is it affecting families and children, but it's affecting the business community. It's affecting our ability to function as an extended community when we can't get enough workers to do what is needed. And Chris is going to talk about that topic and what child care has to do with that next week. It's always good to listen to what she's going to have on the program. Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with a joint project with KCBX Public Radio. We appreciate the underwriting of Joan Gellert Sargent and appreciate being able to put these programs on. You can contact us at voices@kcbx.org or 549-8855. And thank you to Donna Cheek, who was our in-studio engineer today, and the listeners of KCBX for supporting public radio that gives us an avenue to be here. Thank you to my guests today, Linda Beck, Catherine Cherkis, and Jenny Molinar, for doing a wonderful program talking about something that I believe affects all of us, even if we're not talking about it right now. So thank you for being with us. This has been Central Coast Voices. It's back to you in the studio, Donna.
This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Arto, and KSBX Santa Barbara, streaming at kcbx.org. Support for KCBX comes from Hospice Slo County, the non-medical volunteer hospice in the county for over 43 years. Hospice Slo County helps those who are facing a life-limiting illness, end of life, or grief. Learn more at hospiceslo.org. And support comes from Pacific Coast Kitchen and Bath, providing plumbing fixtures and hardware to the Central Coast since 1990. Their showroom is on Short Street in San Luis Obispo. Learn more at coastkitchenbath.com. I'm Donna Cheek here with you today until 4 o'clock. Thank you so much for listening. It's 2 o'clock and time for Latino USA.